Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Andrei Kushnir about his book Epic Journey, Life and Times of Vasil Kushnir, which was published by Academic Studies Press in 2020. Andrei Kushnir is an American fine art painter. He's known for his landscapes, city views, and seascapes, but also has created genre, portraits, and still life works. The artist's works are in the permanent collections of the U.S. Coast Guard, District of Columbia's Commission of Arts and Humanities, University of Maryland, University College Maryland, Museum of Florida's Art and Culture, Avon Park, Florida, Virginia Historical Society, Richmond, Virginia, the University Club, Washington, D.C., and Presidents of the United States and Ukraine. Before we discuss your story, will you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Natalia. Thanks for inviting me. I came to write this book through a long journey. In a way, it goes back to Chicago, where I grew up. But my original training was professional training was as an attorney. However, I was always interested in art and going back to my earliest memories in school, I was the kid whose pictures the teachers would hang up and on the walls and that sort of thing. Not always a good thing with the other kids, especially in a kind of a tough neighborhood in Chicago where I grew up in. But anyway, so I had these two kind of interests. To one extent, I am interested in everything. I love music. I love art. I'm also interested in history and politics. And of course, my Ukrainian background was very prominent, being a first generation immigrant from, not from Ukraine, but from Germany. I was born actually in a displaced persons camp in Regensburg, Germany. My parents both had been taken as slave laborers by the Germans to work basically farm work in Germany. They met in the camp, and I was born there. My brother was born there also. My father was his story is really it's interesting in that he did something while he was the slave laborer. He had an opportunity to take a correspondence course, and he was always interested in automobile engines. And so he learned how an engine works and what its parts were, just down to the, you know, smallest detail. And that served him very well after the war when he latched down with the Americans and knew how engines worked, and driving was no problem for him. So he got a job as a driver for the Army. And I think back then, these services all traded with each other. So if you're a driver for the Army, you did it for the UN and for the relief organizations, the ambulances and that sort of thing. Anyway, we came to the United States, and growing up, my parents always encouraged me to to go into something practical, such as being a lawyer or a doctor or that sort of thing. And the legal thing seemed to be the closest to what interested me, although medical things were interesting. But however, I had a side thing of art, and which didn't really come into flower until after I had gotten married. And I started, my wife had a paint box from her high school days, which she gave me, had a bunch of oil paints in it, and I started painting. And I really learned to love it. I also learned to love being outside. And so the painting and the outdoors thing came together. In the meantime, I had progressed and gotten a law degree from Howard University here in Washington, D.C. And I latched on as an attorney with the Federal Aviation Administration, and then later jumped to the Department of the Navy Office of General Counsel. The legal work was, you might think it might be boring, but I fell into the area of government contracts. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that happen in the world of government contracts. I did some litigation, was able to travel quite a bit doing this kind of work. And at one time, I was the legal counsel for the Naval Supply Depot in Yokosuka, Japan, for a couple of years. And by that time, I was painting. And I did some painting. I never did some plein air painting in Japan, because I didn't really get into that until we got back. But the legal part of me was one part, and then the painting part was the other part. And I actually found that the one helped the other. You learn things as a lawyer about putting things together, and you making an argument, but it's kind of the same thing in the pictorial sense, where you have a general subject, and then you have the supporting elements and that sort of thing. I fortunately, or well, it could have been unfortunately, but the Navy activity that I was with, the Naval Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command, moved to San Diego, and I was able to retire early at the age of 50, and with the permission of my wife, she said, you know, you're painting and you talk about it all the time. Why don't you use this as an opportunity to jump into what you really want to do? And so I did. I jumped full into it, and I was fairly lucky. Within a couple of years after swimming around in the art world, I got into a gallery here in Washington, D.C., whose owner, Michelle Taylor, was also an artist. And she saw my drive, and she helped me transition to painting larger paintings the thoughts of design and color and that sort of thing. And I found that the parts of my life that dealt with the legal profession really helped me in keeping records, keeping track of things in the business aspect, but also helped with the artistic parts. So the both of them kind of progressed together. And ultimately, I was able to enter into a lot of competitions, art shows and such, and slowly began a career as an artist. Through that, ended up owning a couple of art galleries. I still own one here in Washington, D.C., American Painting Fine Art. But the first two were as business partner with Michelle Taylor, who kind of knew the ropes of the art world. And I was kind of the detail guy, since I knew about keeping records and that sort of thing. And we ended up with one gallery in Ellicott City and another in Manhattan, actually in the Ukrainian village, which was a great accomplishment as far as I was concerned. I was there. And in fact, our gallery faced Tarasuchenko place, right a few doors down from the Ukrainian Museum, and it was very comfortable. I still lived here. My business partner, Michelle, moved up to New York, and she lived actually in the building where the gallery was. And we were there for 5 years until the downturn happened, and which everything kind of fell apart. Plus, Cooper Union, which was right across the street from us, decided to build this new building, and it just became impossible to do business there for a few years, in which case she ended up moving back across the country, and I had to close the gallery. I still keep some contacts in New York, but I at the same time, I opened a shop here in Washington, D.C., and that's where my art is shown primarily, and where I have a little office and a gallery, and so it's good. In the meantime, my parents, who were living in Chicago, in the Chicago area, they moved to a little suburb called Palatine, and they had a couple of acres there. My father really got into beekeeping, which his father did as a back in Ukraine. And so they also had, it was probably a Ukrainian immigrant's dream come true. They had a huge garden and a kitchen garden. They grew everything. And they also had fruit trees, raspberries, strawberries, every kind of tomato, every vegetable you can think of, plenty of flowers. And they did sell some honey and produce like that. Ultimately, they ended up moving to Florida as they got a little older and they wanted to be in a bit of a better climate. In the meantime, I'm kind of progressing, trying to progress the story in a unified way. But in the meantime, you know, you grow up in a household where your parents primarily speak Ukrainian, and you hear these stories, and the stories just keep coming. And to some extent, it's in one ear and out the other. You're in a different world from what they're in, and but being the eldest of the family and closest and remembering actually being in Germany very, very poorly, but I do remember a little bit of it. And you feel a little closer. I know that my brother Anatoly and myself seem to be a little bit more receptive to the Ukrainian immigrant experience. My sister and younger brother, my sister Nadia and younger brother Volodya, are much more integrated into the American culture, I think. Although they're both real dogmatic Ukrainians as well, so it's their attitudes are just slightly different from Tony's and mine. But my father had this almost I don't want to say cross to bear. His family had gone through some horrific experiences. Members had been sent to Siberia, other places in the Soviet Russian Empire, and these things were always on his mind. And at one point, he was talking about, "Well, I need to get this out of my system. I need to tell somebody my story." And he had checked around about finding maybe someone who might record these things or this sort of idea. Ultimately, it occurred to me, actually, I learned, and he showed me a bunch of things that he had. He had a lot of postcards, which blew my mind. These were cards that his father had sent to him while he was a slave laborer in Germany from Ukraine. how could this be? And he said, well, they had a very efficient postal system. You bought a card that was attached to another card, and you filled out yours, and you put your return address on it and such, and you sent it to them. Then when they got it, they filled out their part, and they sent it back to you. And through the system, you were able to get. So he doesn't have the cards that he sent to them, but he does have their cards to him, which I found very fascinating. He also had a postcard that he received from his uncle, Danilo, who had been sent also to Siberia. And then this, it's really worthy of a movie. They were building bunkers against the Japanese for the Soviet Union. And when they finished building the bunkers, the conscripts in these camps had to take the bunkers apart. They loaded them on trains and transported them back through Moscow and up to the Arctic Circle. I didn't even know there was a country called Komi, K-O-M-I. Actually, there's websites with them now. And in fact, I found some YouTube videos of some of the step logs, the camps that existed up there. There were the people who made them were either imprisoned in them or, anyhow, my uncle was with a group that was building bridges over the Yenisei River, which is apparently one of the longest rivers in the world. But up there, he had said that the vegetation was so stunted, you couldn't even cut a tree that would be as high as an axe hand, as an axle. So anyhow, he was up there, and they lost track of him up there. But my father had these documents, and interestingly, I recently came across the book that he actually learned about automobile engines.
Oh, really?
That he got while he was in Germany. He had all these things, and he was always interested in photography. And so he took a gazillion pictures, and they were all in little canisters. And once I got into this project, I decided, you know, the lawyer part of me thought, well, geez, there's all this evidence. These aren't just stories. Yeah. These just aren't someone's memories that might be wrong, that might be exaggerated. There's some documentary evidence here. So I assigned my father a task. I said, you know, I'll do this darn thing, but you got to help me out. How about writing some of this stuff down? He just went right to it, and he wrote, I don't know, 30, 40 pages in tiny little Ukrainian writing, mostly stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. You know, one sentence going a page or two pages long, which then I realized if I'm going to do this, I'd have to really to understand it, to translate it. So this is one of these things that took, I don't know, 15 years to over a period of time. Just my part of it. And I'm glad that he did it early on, because toward the end, the last couple of years of his life, there were some holes that needed to be in his narrative. And I asked him, I would write questions out to him, and I said, can you just respond to these questions? Well, his responses were not very satisfactory. He would just start repeating what he had written before. The good thing was they were down in Florida, and my brother Wally, who lived with them, would hear them from him. And so I very carefully worked through Wally to find out whether the stories changed over time, whether they were different from what I got. And darn, it was the same thing. It's not like he memorized the same words, but he would go over the same details with him. So I had a pretty good feeling that what I was getting at was close to what really happened. And with the various documents, I felt pretty comfortable in putting together a narrative about it. Once I got into the narrative, I thought, geez, I am so lucky that I started this thing, because it was much more complex. There were many more parts to it than I would have ever imagined. I spent a week down in Florida with my father, just actually on the same computer, I made scans of the postcards that he had gotten from his parents, and we went through every postcard, and you know, because the writing was faded, we'd have to blow it up, and together we pasted them together, you know, figured out what they said, and in some cases, I mean, when he was in Germany working for the farmer, he would get these cards and he could understand them right then. But this is 50, 60 years later, looking at them, he couldn't remember some of these things. But together, we were able to piece mostly what was said there. Some of it had been blacked out by censors and such. So that was kind of a fascinating. It was a detective kind of a job. So that's how the book kind of came into being. And the book is totally something different from everything else that I've been doing for the last 20, almost 30 years since I left the Navy, because everything else has been related to my art projects. And I've had a number of them apart from the galleries. I undertook a project about 12, 13 years ago to paint the entire Shenandoah Valley. You need a lot of paint if you're going to paint a whole valley. I fell in with a group of people, including some scholars and people who lived in the valley and geographers and publishers and such, who guided me to places that were historical and cultural interest in the valley. And of course, for an artist, you can't get much better than to have to go out there and stand in some beautiful field or in some little village and do a painting of the scene. So in a way, the paintings kind of are a bit like the book. Mm-hmm. They tell a story. They have context. So really, when I think of it, I'm kind of doing the same thing in both. With both of these projects, the book and the Shenandoah thing, and I also, when we were up in New York, I painted a lot in the East Village. I've got a group of paintings there. I'm working on another book of the paintings of the East Village and what it was like back then. It's now 10 years since that shop closed down, but we were there when there were still things going on, like CBGB, you know, the club, the Amato Opera, the Surma Bookshop, which is closed since then, and so that's in a way I'm very fortunate that been able to use both the legal part, a legal mind part of it, and the art, the part that relates to trying to capture something, an emotion mainly of what the scene is like. Mm-hmm.
The story that you describe is very difficult to read because it triggers deep and intense emotions. And at times, it reads like a movie plot because it's so difficult to believe that one person had to live through all those atrocities that you mentioned. I'm wondering, what was the triggering point for this project? What made you want to share your father's story with the audience and with the public?
Well, it's an evolving thing. I guess it's sort of like life itself. But, you know, in a way, I can apply the same ideas. You know, my father was sort of the main thrust of the main subject of the story. Just as in a painting, you would have the main subject of the painting, and all of these other elements are supportive of it. But it has, in order for it to be, it has to be cohesive, and it has to make sense altogether. And so, you know, if you're an attorney and you have someone on the stand, and they're telling you, and you're asking them about various facts, the other side is going to try to poke holes in their story and find inconsistencies or falsehoods and that sort of thing. And that's the part that I try to work hardest on. And as I mentioned when I was talking about it generally, I tried to probe as much as I could. And some parts of it, you know, I sharpened up, no question. Just a simple thing like, you know, he kept talking about Nova Bubnivka, the town, the village that he grew up. So I said, well, yeah, this wasn't in his original telling of it. So I said, well, what was the town like? Who were the people there? How did it get the name? These kind of things. Now, so, you know, how it got the name, I didn't go back to authorities in Ukraine and question them. Give me the genealogy of the name of this thing. I took it on faith. But certain things, for instance, his understanding was he thought that his grandfather, the one who had been executed by the Czechists, had been a Serb. Well, you know, after I put the story into chronological order, I found that he was born after serfdom ended. So he couldn't have been a serf. So I said that. So then my father says, well, I know he was very poor. And in fact, his wife, Yarina, who was my great grandmother, she actually lived throughout this whole thing longer than anybody. Mm-hmm. She was the anchor for this thing. So when his father and mother were taken to prison, to Siberia and to Mariupol, he lived with his grandmother, with Yarina, and his uncle, Danilo, lived with Yarina. And then I asked my father, now, how did they let her, you know, they killed her husband. How did they let her live? He says, well, you know, she came from an extremely poor family, and she was like an untouchable, even to the communists. The more downtrodden you were, the greater you were elevated with respect. And so she somehow was able to survive, even though members of her family were shot and, you know, beaten, tortured, sent to Siberia, this kind of thing. She persevered through all these things going through her. And she ended up dying in Ukraine. I guess it was in the 60s. My grandmother lived with her. She was apparently 96 when she died. So her life was slightly longer than my father's, but she had, you know, her life goes back to the previous century. So anyway, the story sort of unfolded. The initial part that got me interested was when these Czechists came and shot my great grandfather in front of his family. And that was my father's initial, I don't want to say origin story, but that's kind of the thing that prompted all these things. So when I'm tracing through this, I noticed that that's kind of the fact that my grandfather was in the Pechura army that became a stain on everything from that point on. And no matter what amnesties were proclaimed or what other corrective things people tried to do, once you had that stain, no, you couldn't get rid of it in that society. Mm-hmm. So it was my duty, I felt, was to cross-check as much of the story as I can, make sure that there weren't instances. The other thing I do want to mention is I made a conscious decision to do this in English because I had given this story to several people to read before I sent it to the publisher. And in each case, I was told, you know, I never knew this. You know, all I knew about what was happening in communist time was from Dr. Zhivago. You know, that's basically the level on which most people understand what life was there. And of course, you know, Ukraine was kind of a closed place. No one could go there, even if you were Ukrainian. And you know, it was sort of like Chernobyl. It was a black hole and no information about the Holodomor, about anything could escape from there. So the idea was, well, here was an interesting story that covered a long period of time. Has a lot of hooks in it to other things that if it was just put forth simply and convincingly in a kind of an unadorned way. I'm not a professional writer. There aren't a lot of adjectives in this. I tried to put it together using my father's words as much as I could, but you know, his words sometimes ran on and on and on. So you had to kind of herd it all together and try to tell it in a linear fashion, like you said, you know, with the start, beginning, and end. And there, I'll make no excuses for it. The thrust of the whole book is about the first two-thirds of it. Mm-hmm. The last third, my part, you know, from the time we came to the United States, actually the early Chicago days were interesting. But after that, it's kind of just, I just had to finish it, get to the present. That's what I felt. So you notice there's a lot more pictures, photos there to just show what life was like in a Ukrainian immigrant's family. And I'm sure if we were Brazilian or Italian or whatever, there would be a version of the same thing, probably, from what I've heard from what other people have described to me. So the thrust of it was that first two-thirds of the book. Mm-hmm.
Your father was sent to Germany during the Second World War, but after the Second World War, he did everything he could to not return back to Ukraine, which was under the Soviet rule at that moment. Then he ended up in the United States, and I would say from that point on, his story turned into a story of success, probably to some extent. He was able to find a good job, and it took him just a couple of years to start making money. And your family was able to afford things which, for many Ukrainians at that moment, were luxuries, cars, private properties, houses. I'm wondering what memory of his motherland your father wanted to share with you. What memory about his motherland he wanted to transmit? You did mention the fact that when you were in Chicago, you went to the St. Volodymyr Cathedral School, where you learned the Ukrainian language and where you probably also learned something about Ukrainian culture and history. However, I'm more interested in those personal stories and those personal memories that your father wanted to share with you. And how did your father want you to remember Ukraine?
You know, that's a very good question, because it's interesting. His whole life in Ukraine was, during that time, had all these hardships, had these incidents where he was ridiculed, where he was you were very careful at every step because anything you could say could be used against you. That was his memory of Ukraine, you know. And yet he loved the place, and so it's kind of an interesting set of facts that a person who came from a background in a place that was not very pleasant could have such a drive and a feeling of warmth for that place. My father and mother spoke as one. In our family, you couldn't use the one against the other, as so often happens in more modern contexts. But there, you know, my mother was totally supportive, and he was supportive of her, and, you know, the community, and I think most Ukrainian communities in the United States, you know, there, I just recently saw the little movie called Folk about Ukrainian folk dancing. They're kind of lost in, I don't want to say a time warp, but they dwell on the positive aspects of the culture, not the political situation that existed there back in Ukraine. So within the church and the Ukrainian schools, they would teach you the geography and the history of the people. And so you got, and of course, all your closest friends were Ukrainian, had American friends as well, but the folks, the ones from church and from the Ukrainian organizations, those were the ones that you know, of course, your parents approved of them and they liked them because they could understand them and they knew their parents. So it's not a situation like here where your kids go to school and they're rubbing elbows with you don't know who. And that's not a bad thing in a way. It's a very worldly thing. It's not insular and it's not provincial, which our experience was much more. But yet it is an interesting observation that the thing, your question, that his feelings for the culture overcame his revulsion of what was happening there by the in the political realm in the country.
Did your father have a chance to go to Ukraine after 1991?
Once Ukraine proclaimed its freedom, my brother and I got involved it's a separate story that could possibly be a little movie too. Were a bunch of people who wanted to improve airports in Ukraine. First Kyiv Airport, and then our biggest project was the Kharkiv Airport, Ukraine's second largest city. And so my brother and I had gone there a couple of times, and we talked to my parents about this, and they said, well, you know, my father says, I want to go back and see what it, you know, and go see what it's like. And so back, I think it was around 93, 94, they went back together and told the end of the book with some pictures about it, and he describes what they saw. They took a trip on the Strila, the boat that goes to Shevchenko's where he's buried, and they visited Kyiv. And fortunately, my wife had been in a student exchange program, and she knew a principal of a Ukrainian school who, when they were in Kyiv, helped them a lot. In fact, I don't know if they may have stayed with her or this stuff. She took care of them. But they went back. This is interesting. This is in the book. But they went back to the village where, to Nova Bubnivka, to visit it. And some of this information I got more from my mother than my father, because my father was very, you know, well, I'm going to go back there and I'm going to tell them, you know, how wrong they were, and, you know, look at us. We're this kind of thing. And my mother said, "You better watch out. You better watch out." So they had somebody who a relative or a friend who was driving them into the village, and there was some man walking on the road. And my father asked the guy, the driver, to stop, and he says, "Hey, listen, I'm going there." To move up. That's where my parents were. My grandfather was killed by the communists there. And I'm going to go try to find his grave. And you know, we're now in America. And he said this guy was a very aggressive, hard line. I don't know what, but he says, well, you better watch out because the same thing's going to happen to you. And my mother said, from that time on, my pop was very quiet about his background and that sort of thing, because recognizing that just as in this country, it's still civil war is still being fought in many places. Back there, there are a lot of people who are crying over the fact that the downfall of communism and how good things were then, and now everything's uncertain. And so it's memory is a funny thing. It glows often when it shouldn't be glowing. So in a way, my father's situation kind of preserved an outlook that is at odds with reality in contemporary Ukraine. And of course, since the 2014 revolution, there's another changeover, flow over of feelings and acceptance of a national identity, which had been submerged during the communist era.
Mm-hmm. You speak Ukrainian, and you also mentioned that some of your family members also speak Ukrainian. But I'm wondering what other, so to speak, Ukrainian things you preserve or you keep in your household, maybe Ukrainian food or Ukrainian holidays.
My wife makes the absolute, her borscht is as good as my mom's.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's, and it's vegetarian,
oh.
You know, she makes all the Ukrainian, you know, varenika, the whole, she can do everything else. And it's not that anybody, she just loves it. Music, we have a huge CD collection and we've gone to concerts. I'm fortunate being in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
the Ukraine is here. And at one time, I had an exhibit at the Virginia Historical Society down in Richmond. And by a really fortunate set of circumstances, the Voice of America, Slavko Novitsky, who was a Ukrainian film producer who worked for the Voice of America, made a little 5-minute program about the exhibit, which was actually then shown in Ukraine. And I found that after that happened, the people in the embassy, all of a sudden, you know, I got calls, I got invitations to everything. I was a bigger star in Ukraine than I ever was here. It was funny, but I have very warm relations with the embassy of Ukraine. I also, you know, I'm a member of our church here, I'm talking about Chicago, St. Andrew, mm-hmm. Ukraine Orthodox Church. My wife's family is from Toronto area in Canada, and her nephew married a lady from Ukraine, and they have a little baby, and so there's still these big broad connections with all of my parents' kids. There were four of us had married other Ukrainian Americans here. Now, that's not true of our kids. For some reason, maybe we, you know, see it was just too much. I don't know what it is, but it's fine. Everybody accepts it. Everybody knows that this is our heritage, our culture, where we come from, and it's a good culture. You know, that's one of the things I'm proud of. You know, Ukraine, the nation never attacked anyone, never enslaved anyone, never, I mean, throughout history, we were the slaves, you know. So in a way, we were, it's got a very good record. And right now there's a lot of very positive things going on. There's a great dialogue going on between the Ukrainians and the Jewish community in Ukraine and in general. And the Poles are from the time of independence have been our biggest supporters. You know, the countries around Ukraine seem to be very supportive, other than our neighbor to the north. You know, And in fact, it's a sad situation because, you know, the Russian people are great people also. They just have leaders who pick at the things that are very divisive and have a kind of megalomaniac kind of sort of attitude about mm-hmm. about. But in general, we're within our household, we speak English, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Ukraine for a week at a time back in the 90s, you wouldn't believe how good my Ukrainian became. I even was thinking in Ukrainian, and it's just the usage is what determines things. But on the other hand, you know, I realize I'm in the United States. I'm an American. I play the banjo. Mm-hmm. I play, I like American music. Actually, I like American music as much as I like Ukrainian music. Ukrainian music to me is often very sad. And but it's very dear as well. So that's kind of rounded out picture.
Did you have a chance to paint when you were in Ukraine, for example, the views of the Dnipro River?
I didn't paint. I was there. It was such an intense experience with the project that we were trying to put together. But I took a lot of pictures, and I have done some. I have painted from one of my a couple of my photos, a picture of Volodymyr over the Dnipro. Mm-hmm. I actually also here in Washington, I painted the Shevchenko Monument a number of times. I painted the Ukrainian Institute in New York. I painted the Ukrainian paintings of the Ukrainian Embassy a couple of times. One of them actually was purchased by the staff of Ambassador Shamshuk from Ukraine as a present for him. So I'm just as happy to paint do a painting of a Ukraine subject here as I am of the Shenandoah Valley. It's another subject and it's another something to be able to try to exercise my creativity against.
Thank you so much for your book, which provides this very insightful perspectives on some personal stories, on some personal histories. But as I already mentioned, this story is not entirely personal because you took it to a different level, to the level of stories that emerge between the nations and between the states. Now, on the one hand, this story does provide this very personal insight on how we probably establish our relationships with people with whom we share one story, one history, one geography, one space. The book is very hard to read, and at times, probably one will have to take a break because all those atrocities that you describe really makes one think how difficult it is to live through all those tragedies. However, what I admire actually about your father's story is that he was able to somehow survive build his new life in the United States. Well, thank you so much for your moving book.
Thank you, Natalia. Thanks for having me.
Today, I spoke with Andrei Kushnir, author of Epic Journey, Life and Times of Vasil Kushnir, which was published by Academic Studies Press in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.